星空を眺めている一人きりの夜明けもたった一つの心悲しみに暮れないで君のため息なぬて春風に変えてやる日の当たる坂道を自転車で駆け上る君となるした思い出乗せてゆくよララララララ口ずさむ唇を染めてゆく君の見つけた幸せ花のように。
Keep going. So, Emily McCavan, McCaven, McAvan, McCavan. Cavan sounds good.
Yeah.
Cavan like a cave. Yeah. All the diaspora, they all say it the different ways. It's Donaghy, no Donaghy. No, actually, it's Donaghy if you say it. But and boring ass pronouns, you got your. Just a girl.
Just a fat middle-aged woman.
It's like I don't know when you're middle-aged. I don't know who you're supposed to compare yourself to decide whether you're fat or not.
Go with
the mean and just try not to let people be mean. Emily, like I gotta get into this with you. I feel like we've just stumbled onto something, and starting to come into relation together through research project, big spirituality, sociology of religion project. And I think what we're gonna start exploring is there's a narrative going on, and I think it's very much spiritual in nature, and it's been around for a few millennia maybe, but particularly the last few centuries, and I think it's right there behind nationalism and Christian nationalism and all kinds of religious nationalism. But we suspect it might be, behind a lot of the biggest issues that are, one of the biggest issues, but the issues that are getting the most attention, and that are kind of distracting away from any kind of solutions that we might have to meta crisis problems. But anyway, I want to queer this stuff up, particularly because I feel like that's the only way to get into this one. I feel like we need that eye on it. So anyway, So kicking off, like, just the intro for you, and then we might start thinking about those ideas about what's toxic, what's polluting, what's contagious, and where all these narratives, weird narratives, are going for us with immigration and everything, all the big ones. We'll try and weave it all together. Sanga, where are you now with your coffee, or is it a tea?
Yeah, I'm halfway through my cup of coffee. I'm good to go.
All right. And you're in like a university office.
No, this is my library, in our apartment, which we, so I have a couple bookshelves behind me.
Ah, sweet.
And an apartment in Pran, in Nam. So yeah.
All right. Oh man, we should have met up for this. So you are like 5 km away from me or something.
Oh really?
Next time, face to face.
Absolutely.
And so you're a Deakin Uni.
Yeah. So I teach in the literature and gender studies departments. And I have one of those honorary fellowship things, which means the university gets to take my research and give me very little.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, I get people to pay me so I can pay the uni, so that I can do research for the uni. So, yes, it's very exciting. that privilege of research is a that's an interesting labor thing. Anyway, there's some double stuff going on there for adding value to to primary resources there that I don't know. I don't think Marx did the calculations for that one. Anyway, so, but I don't care because the labor that you're producing like blew my mind the other day. Do you want to like just kind of run us through the whole theory and everything and don't rush
it? Sean.
These discourses going on.
So basically my research is on like ideas of pollution and how these are pollution, contagion, toxicity. So thinking about how, you know, like pollution is when a foreign substance gets into an ecosystem or a community or something, and there's contact between, you know, different elements. And, you know, toxicity is imagined, that contact is imagined to be harmful. And when it's contagious, then it spreads from one person to the next, or, you know, from different things to other things. And it kind of occurred to me, you know, my example for that paper was trans people and how trans people are imagined to be this kind of polluting influence in, you know, going to the bathroom and being like somehow dangerous when you want to take a piss. Even though all of the research says that like trans people are more likely to be sexually assaulted than assaulting. So it's like it's an idea about pollution. It's like there is this foreign element that we're scared of, that we think is harmful. You know, the way that trans people is imagined to be like harmful to a healthy body rather than a kind of enactment of themselves. So I'm like playing with these different ideas of pollution and toxicity and contagion in order to kind of map out a lot of the anxieties, like you said, that are going on today.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of gender and sexuality and race and institutions, because I think, you know, often these kinds of ideas are enacted by institutions and governments, as well as by, you know, people who are freaking out, trans kids or whatever.
Yeah. So it seems to be, I think the core part of this is the concept of a boundary or a border and where these things are arbitrary, you know, how permeable they are. How permeable they need to be, you know, I mean, are they semi-permeable? And if so, what are the protocols for regulation of people across these boundaries? Are they boundaries of any kind of integrity, culturally or legally or anything else? And and what are the stories behind the boundaries? Because in our culture, you know, Aboriginal cultures, Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander cultures and Indigenous cultures more globally in a lot of senses too, most of them, you know, we have protocols for these things. But our boundaries in Indigenous cultures are for strengthening relations and making sure relationships are, you know, lasting. And, you know, so, you know, you police your boundaries by, you know, and you do your boundary work in embassy at the borders with at meeting places. You do this with adoption, you know, adopting across. So these are the social ones. And you're marrying across, but also the biological flows across those boundaries. You know, you also adopt different plant species that may not have been in your region before. And then you have lots of protocols and ceremony and land management to happen over time to naturalize these species in properly so they don't run rampant and, you know, end up behaving in invasive ways. So we have a different idea of borders and boundaries in, you know, Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander and generally just Indigenous sort of boundary making as kin making. It's a little bit different in these, in settler cultures and cultures of empire, particularly over the last just over a century since the concept of a nation was invented, you know, which has this idea, it has this sort of purity of the baby at the center of it. You know what I mean? Like this sacred child, you know, whether it's born in a manger or not, it's like this, nation is, you know, from nate, N-A-T, you know, NATO, you know, born. Yeah, so a nation is, you know, the born country, you're born somewhere and somehow that sacrament of that birth is, you know, makes one native, and you have nation and everyone within that boundary, that border that was just invented, is that nation now, you know. So, yeah, you are not Macedonian anymore, you're a Greek boy.
Yeah,
you're a Serb, you're a this. Oh, by the way, you're not Yugoslavian anymore. and lots of Torres Strait Islanders. It's like, oh, hey, sorry, you're not Torres Strait Islander, you're not Australian Indigenous anymore, you're from New Guinea now,
right?
We just put that border through, because NATO slapped Queensland, you know, a couple of decades back. So, Queensland isn't allowed to just call New Guinea Queensland. Okay, yeah. So these things happen. So there's these boundaries, these borders, international law, all these sorts of things. You know, there are international law sort of settles itself and moves and changes and tries to stop, you know, in post sort of decolonization. It tries to change things, tries to move all these kind of things. It tries to prevent, you know, people doing imperialisms, but, you know, that doesn't exactly work. As we see with Russia making moves, all these kinds of things, this is huge. So I think this, what we're looking at here is borders and boundary violation, boundary keeping, and what this is all about. And I think that, I think the queer eye on this is the one for being able to look at and identify the spiritual discourses and narratives behind this. And so let's riff through that. Particularly going into your work, maybe going into that Trinity, that unholy Trinity of pollution, toxicity, and contagion, which coming off the back of COVID, you know, there's.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, borders, drawing a boundary necessarily excludes some people and doesn't, you know, includes others.
Yeah.
And we have to do this to a certain amount.
Yeah.
But it's dangerous when boundaries become rigid. And it's particularly dangerous when the excluded starts to become eliminated.
Yeah.
So it's like part of the issue with the nation state is it's like, okay, so, you know, like I'm born into the nation state and that's wonderful, but there's an internal division where we have to eliminate, you know, colonized people or migrants or whatever it is. So when we start getting into, you know, exclusion as elimination, that's when, you know, things get really bad. You know, like Australia as a nation state drew those boundaries for the white Australia, but it drew them internally too. So I think, yeah, there's this kind of, you start trying to exclude the foreign element entirely from the inside, then, you know, like that's when genocide happens. That's when all kinds of bad things happen. And like that's a super Christian, you know, narrative. This sort of, you know, narrative of innocence, a narrative of purity, that, you know, that there is something righteous in that kind of, you know, exclusion of the foreign. It's super, super Christian in origin, I think, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's been well documented with the White Australia policy, how much of that was, you know, based on Christian narratives, exhortations. Our university, Deakin University, is named after Alfred Deakin, who was pretty much the godfather of the White Australia policy. Edmund Barton, his predecessor, was Australia's first prime minister. You know, he is the one who put it in place, but initially. But, you know, Deakin was the one who was pushing it before that, Alfred Deakin. And he's the one who really ramped it up, really installed it, made it happen, made it work. And he pushed it with a lot of rhetoric, you know, a lot of ideas of Christian purity, which were not just racial, but also gendered.
Yeah, and sexual. You know,
this idea of the family and what the family is, that it is this pure thing.
And queer and trans people spoil the purity of the family, you know, contagious, you know, like you can't have queer parents because they'll, you know, make their kid turn out queer. It's contagious. So, you know, like we have to protect the family from, you know, from what's inside it or potentially inside it too. So, you know, queers can be both the kind of outsider that's inside or the insider that's outside and trouble that sense of boundary. And, you know, like, yeah, as a community, so many of us have the story of being, you know, expelled from our families or expelled from our communities. And so that kind of, you know, removal of the foreign element because it's not pure. Is kind of inherent to the experience still today.
And that's that style of border policing that isn't about strengthening relations at the borders.
No.
But on, you know, using, like, weaponizing borders, you know. Yeah. So I guess when everybody in Australia voted for it, yes, of course, like, you know, same-sex couples can get married, of course. That wasn't like, you know, so I guess a lot of the Christian right, and, you know, a lot of the lobby groups, et cetera, that like to sort of, you know, pursue these things to keep everybody, you know, endlessly going around in culture wars rather than trying to meaningfully, you know, stop, you know, rampant resource extraction and the actual poisoning of the world.
To
get people focused on these poisons. So I guess the way that was rewritten in the spiritual narrative of all of the, you know, the propaganda and radicalization kind of content, was that the boundary had been assaulted. The boundary of purity around the Australian family had been assaulted. Not that it had been, you know, just... the protocols at the border had been changed in its semi-permeability in ways that would include the people who are already inside those freaking borders to make them safe. So we're making people safe within the border itself hasn't been moved. The border itself hasn't been changed. It's just, you know, the the people policing that border just have just another PDF to look at briefly and shift the way they police the border. You know, it's not a big one. But anyway, it has been, you know, I think that was deeply upsetting to a lot of people. And that they sort of spent those years regrouping while everybody else sort of fell into a kind of, you know, relaxed stupor around, okay, well, this is good. We're safe within these borders now.
Right.
You know, around, like, you know, the family is now, you know, a stronger boundary and stronger border that actually protects all the people in that family, not just the ones on the poster. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the right-wing response to marriage equality was to go, well, we've lost that battle, so we're now going to, you know, concentrate on trans issues, which we feel like we can win more of. And I think that kind of move is not actually accidental because, you know, they feel that there is something like material in terms of the kind of pollution of of bodies, you know, that the trans bodies are kind of polluted bodies. So it's like, okay, well, we're gonna shift the border to trans medicine, which had not been particularly controversial. And now it's like this incredible kind of argument over like, do people have the right to control their own bodies and to make their own bodies?
Well, the T, it was a, you know, I guess if you're looking to, you know, attack LGBTQIA plus agenda, like, et cetera, the T is the point of weakness where you can come in the governance, you know, in queer governance, you know, of the movement, you know, because there's, you know, a lot of like settler homonormative, you know, like cis dudes running the show and on the committees and stuff like that. You know what I mean? There's, you know, that hadn't really figured out the trans stuff yet, or, you know, that was just there. It was just there, but it wasn't really, you know, there wasn't much solidarity around that. So it was a weak spot where you could, you know, you could get Naomi Wolf in there bloody chipping away.
and I think, you know, like those narratives about, I don't know, purity, kind of it links into other, you know, that kind of wellness type stuff, you know.
Yeah. Like,
the body has to be pure and, you know, you've got to eat organic food and, you know, do yoga every morning to, like, you know, have a pure body to expel to expel the cultural, to expel, you know, making, to, you know, to get rid of those foreign elements from the self.
Yep.
Okay, well, you know, we can't, trans people maybe are inherently impure, a mixture of different elements, and that's
mixture. Scary. Mixture is the thing. And here's where the eugenics comes in. And this has a really strong mythological, you know, source behind it. You know, the big spiritual mythologies here around the, especially, and this is often, you know, in the old stories, you know, in the sort of source narratives behind the big monotheistic religions, you know, the metaphor is the human animal chimera. You know, there's this mixing of human and animal, you know, this idea, oh, no, humans and animals, humans and nature must be separate. You know, anybody who has totemic relations, they're doing animism, which is nature worship, ancestor worship, all this kind of thing, which is evil, which is pagan, which is satanic, you know. So, you know, so it's linked in with the indigenous side like that. But the whole trans thing, you know, that's the perfect point of entry for signaling, you know, people who are already indoctrinated, you know, deeply through these human animal chimera sort of narratives, which you see a lot of conspiracy theories about. Oh, do you know they're making pig men? The army's making like half dog, half, you know what I mean? These sorts of things. So, of course, you know, the big signal for the trans thing became that just that invented narrative by Joe Rogan about the kitty litter for furry kid in classrooms. That's the code. That's the dog whistle, you know, for the anti-trans stuff.
Yeah.
You know? And
literally so, dehumanization.
Yeah. So that's the dog whistle in. And then, you know, and it's through that spiritual narrative. And then it's like the whole thing of, you know, like trans kids in sport. So then they can slide in on the, like they're really just really interested in women's equality. And
yeah, I've never seen so many right-wing fans of women's sport in my life.
Yeah.
Like, there's only 15% of, you know, coverage of sports is of women's sports, but suddenly all these people actually care about it. It's like, yeah, sure you do.
Yeah. But that's, it's the pollution thing.
Yeah.
All these people are like, oh, because it's, you know, people aren't interested in like safe spaces for women, things like this. That's not how the society's set up. Anytime anybody wants to make a safe space on campus for women or something like that, you know, that's opposed violently. But then all of a sudden, when it's about boundary enforcement around purity and around like the settler women, you know, and safe spaces, you know, for, you know, this protected part of the, of, you know, the family, the everything else. Then all of a sudden it's like, no, we need these safe spaces for women.
But yeah.
Not where women are safe from sexual assault from, like, you know, their male relatives or anything, or partners, or, you know, other sort of settlers were lurking in the scrub on campus or anything like that. We don't want to make them safe from them, but we do need to make them safe from these really evil interlopers.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, like the spectacle of white women being rescued by white men. Damsel in distress. It's a really old one. It's, you know, has all of these kinds of, you know, gendered and sexual and raced implications and connotations. And I think it's just, you know, there has to be a boogeyman, right? You know, like there has to be a scapegoat.
Well, the intellectual right and all of these think tanks and all of this, you know, all the influencers and all that kind of stuff, and the Jordan B. Petersons, you know, they talk a lot about archetypes.
Yeah.
About mythical archetypes. That's a lot of their, that's a lot of their theoretical sort of basis behind things. All these archetypes and heroes' journeys and all that kind of thing. So I think, I think you're onto something there.
Yeah. So, you know, and some women have never been safe, and some women's safety has never been a priority. So it's like a super, super privileged idea that is held out to be universal because it's a border, because it's a boundary, but it has never been universal. And some women have, you know, of all kinds of, you know, social locations, being exposed to, like you say, violence and, you know, sexual violence, and nobody cares until suddenly, you know, like a particularly kind of privileged idea of womanhood, of white womanhood, of, you know, of heterosexual cis womanhood can be used by greater institutions and greater politics. You know, I think that's, you know, where the trans exclusionary feminism and right wing, that's where they meet, is this image of, you know, white womanhood under siege. And so, you know, like that is the image of purity, and women and children onto the lifeboats first.
Yeah.
And ignoring all kinds of violence against other women, which have never been a priority for the right wing ever. So.
Yeah. So there are these three kinds of threat to the sacred, sanctified boundary of the natal. Born into this protected, privileged, boundaried, safe space for particular kinds of hierarchies. There are three mythologies of the other entering and threatening these protected spaces for power. So there's the toxicity. So the idea that that this is being poisoned, and you see this emerging really strongly, not even just as dog whistles anymore, but as, you know, immigrants are poisoning the blood of the nation. We're getting that from, you know, a former and probably a future president of what they call the free world, which is a whole other boundary. That's like both a boundary and a boundary violator, that one. Yeah, so we have the toxicity, that poisoning the blood, poisoning of the blood. You know, and we'll get into all the different ways that same narrative comes into environmentalism, you know, border control, freaking everything, man. You know, we're sort of looking at gender quite a bit, but that's our way in, I think. So there's toxicity. Then there is contagion. And see, that's interesting, because then, and I guess from the trans point of view, we can probably get into that in a minute, the idea of, you know, how it's spreading, how it's like contagious. You have one kid who like experiences this illness, this disease of gender dysphoria or something, and then passes it on to everybody else through a kind of contagious coolness or something, trending, you know, identity. So hang on, toxicity, contagion, and then we've got to come back around to the man, what was the other one? Toxicity, pollution. Contagion, pollution. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. All right. So yeah, let's go.
Let's go.
Contagion. We're up to contagion.
Yeah.
And the rise of this during the pandemic, you know, with everyone's panic about contagion in an actual pandemic, you know, people ended up panicking and having moral panics about far more than just, you know, the disease. Absolutely. Public medicine was one, but also that was the rise of the really big, you know, anti-trans sort of backlash thing going on.
Yeah. And
contagion.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's this idea, and there's a psychologist who calls it a, you know, social contagion, you know, that if one person is allowed to exist, you know, without being tremendously traumatized, then they will cause other people to become trans. And, you know, the idea that queerness was contagious is itself a very old idea, you know, this kind of, and, you know, it's not that we are not imprinted on by other people, you know, like we, you know, like if you see somebody living a life, you might say, oh, that life is potentially livable for me. But when something is described as contagious, then there is this sense that it is, you know, dangerous in its ability to spread, that it might, you know, and then we link into the toxicity, that if it's something that is toxic and it's spreading, then it's like, oh no, there's something that's, you know, something that's dangerous. And so as well as, you know, threatened womanhood, we have motherhood. So, you know, this idea that our children are all going to have blue hair and pronouns, you know, this kind of, if one,
like
then they all become trans and then we won't
it's be like the discourses of contagion, toxicity, pollution. It's like they can't exist without this counterbalancing mythology of purity.
There
must be purity discourses in order to support you know, these very spiritualized narratives of contagion, toxicity, etc., pollution.
And it's like if you don't see transness or queerness as, you know, immoral or impure or whatever, then so what if teenagers want to try something on, and sometimes it sticks and sometimes it doesn't, and we should be okay with that. You know, like there's this kind of sense that if you, you know, let children explore potentialities with gender, like let them explore, then they'll just be harmed by that process. I'll tell you, I had a child who was 13 years old who tried out non-binary pronouns. It didn't stick. And has had zero harm from that and zero harm from her parents trying to make her into something.
Mm.
You know, we said,
well,
sure, explore it, and it didn't stick. And, you know, if it's
here's where the health,
who cares?
Here's where health and wellness comes in.
Mm.
Because this is another, you know, purity thing that's in sort of this toxic feedback loop that is actually toxic, you know, mm-hmm. between India and the Anglo world, you know, these narratives of natural self-healing, you know, like, you know, if you are an optimal person, you know, from an optimal caste biologically, then, you know,
mm-hmm.
you can self-optimize and natural medicine is great. So here's where it comes in. This idea that modern medicine, science, etc., is evil, bad, impure, etc., that medical interventions are, you know, are toxic, unnatural, you know, polluting, etc. And I think the panic, the moral panic around that, that was augmented during COVID, you know, with the actual pandemic. Yeah, the moral panic around public medicine, but also medical intervention, particularly surgical or medicine, as in, you know, like, so like puberty blockers, things like this.
Yes.
You know, the idea of chemical intervention and surgical intervention with people, even though this is, you know, like statistically pretty damn tiny part of the population and rare and like really complex, you know, data just around those very small minority populations. This was sort of conflated into a larger moral panic. And that was also spiritualized. It's like these demonic forces, you know, through the medical system, because they're all in one big conspiracy together. You know, they are conspiring to, you know, poison the blood of the nation, poison, you know, with immigrants, etc. But also, you know, to poison gender, you know, to poison this purity of gender and sexuality through medical intervention. Yeah, it's not just the vaccines and the chemicals turning the frogs gay. It's like they're doing that in nature, in the environment. That's the pollution part. They're doing it here through medical intervention. And you can see it through all the, you watch the evolution of RFK, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who started out in environmentalism and was trying to remove mercury pollution from rivers, and a lot of those things, you know, then of course stuff comes in there about neurodivergence and this sort of disgust about people with autism, you know, like they're just, you know, gone, finished, and that everybody, their IQs are being lowered, you know, because of this pollution, et cetera, et cetera. And then he just pivoted. Like, it was seamless going from there into vaccines, because, you know, he goes in chasing mercury and vaccines, and then all of that's gone. So then he goes into the next part and the next part and the next part. And the trans stuff, effortless coming through there. So, you know, and they all the anti-vax people I know, they all talk about surgical intervention with trans kids and stuff like this, and panic and fear that their children are going to be turned gay or trans without their knowledge by these librarians and teachers who are all part of the same cabal. It's, don't tell me it's not a spiritual narrative. I just laid down the weft to there, so you go with the weave and see what comes across there.
I think some of it is the sense that, you know, the very, you know, the body itself can be polluted by the influence of the wrong kind of energy, you know, masculine or feminine, that, you know, rather than being like, okay, so everybody has a mixture of testosterone and estrogen amongst their, you know, that we can, you know, consciously shape. It's more this kind of idea that, like, if you intervene in that, and, you know, as, like, many of us take all kinds of medications to intervene in our bodies all the time, But just this one kind of, you know, intervention is somehow dangerous because it's, you know, bringing in the wrong kind of thing, you know, the wrong kind of hormone from outside. Yep.
Rather, oh, it's all right though for you. If you wanted to have HRT, that's fine. If you want to have hormone replacement therapy over the next decade, that's all right, because that's about, you know.
Yeah, it's like
you're retaining your femininity. And by the way, you know, I'm 50, so you know, I don't quite get as hard as I used to. So it's fine if I get a bit of extra tea.
But top those, up but to those
maintain are, that, that yeah. that's fine. You know, those, but that's natural.
Yeah,
that's natural. If you want to talk about natural.
Yeah, it's supplementing the body rather than changing it. And it's like, well, when we supplement the body, we do change it, we do shape it.
Yeah.
And, you know, to bring that back to like, you know, nature and the environment, you know, like this idea that like the Australian, you know, like that country is like this wilderness, but it has been consciously shaped for thousands and thousands of years. And it's the same with the body, this idea that, you know, we cannot consciously shape it, that it has to be wilderness. It's just not true. That's just not how people live.
And the idea of the wilderness, that's a purity thing too. Like God designed that. And that is a thing that's been designed for us as being separate from it to dominate and you. It's, you know what I mean? But those of us who are, you know, born native, you know, like to that one, then we've been placed there through that sacrament of birth, through that that pure woman, that pure Christian woman there in that place, sanctified by the marriage that's, you know, and the sin has been removed through this or that. And there we are, pure, in this pure, untouched wilderness. And by God, we can then touch it, because we have that privilege. I think that's the idea. But it's not, but we don't have that. So like, you know, Indigenous people, we don't have a word for nature. Like, we don't have this separate thing. There isn't this idea of land untouched by humans as being more pure, because no, we're in it. We have an ecological niche. We have a custodial niche. So land is sick unless we're in there, actually, you know, managing within it as part of that system, that natural system. So and that includes flows of migratory species coming through all the time. There's magpie geese that come down, you know, past us here and go around in a big dog leg through Gunditj Murra country and everything, that, like, you know, a few months before were right up the top of Australia, my homeland there, you know. Not to mention bloody me doing my own bloody economic migrations here, and just the diaspora that we all are in all the time. My God. And then, I don't know, like, do we even get into the Jewish thing too, if we're talking about diaspora?
Well,
that's got to come in too.
For me, as a Jew, you know, I think like there are quite a lot of conspiracy theories about, you know, specific Jewish billionaires like Soros and there's actually a Jewish billionaire who is a trans woman, Pritzker. And there are all these conspiracy theories about how, like in the United States, about how trans medicine is actually a Jewish conspiracy theory, like it's a Jewish conspiracy. You know, it links in with this idea of, you know, Jews that cannot be fit, you know, can't fit into categories, you know, the root cosmopolitan Jew, you know, the Jew that, you know, looks white but isn't quite white. You know, has to be kind of, you know, removed from the purity of the nation.
Yeah.
So there are all
this idea that you get a pass as an Orthodox Jew.
I'm not Orthodox, but
I'm just saying that you get a pass from the right if you're Orthodox Jew, because it's kind of like, well, you're still, you know, that's okay. You're still part of that original pure group that was God's chosen before they became polluted people and polluted with secularism, you know, because that, et cetera, because this is the big beef. It's with secular Jews, you know, people who are racially Jewish, but who are not, are not sanctified by this religious sort of thing. So there's that kind of purity.
This kind of, like, you know, bringing together of opposites of being simultaneously, you know, capitalist and communist at the same time, you know, this kind of overdetermined position, you know, is intimately familiar as a Jew and as a trans woman, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just it's just really interesting how much of the spiritual narratives are appropriated.
Yeah.
You know, so a lot of the, you know, spiritual narratives are taken and then, you know, from people who are loathed.
And
you know, the spiritual stories are taken and become like the central part of the mythology of a group that's trying to maintain its own purity, but have had to borrow stories from hated outsiders to do it. And I think the Matrix movies are a really good example, because I think most of your modern forms of all of these spiritual narratives of exclusion and, you know, border enforcement and all this kind of thing, you know, they adopt those narratives and metaphors spiritually from the Matrix films, like, you know, the whole idea of the red pill and blue pill, et cetera, et cetera. And then, you know, but they have trouble coming to grips with the fact that, like, the Matrix trilogy was an analogy, was a fable, a story about, you know, trans siblings trying to come to terms with being trans in a world that sort of, you know, was hostile to them being who they were.
It's this kind of, you know, supreme irony that the most misogynistic people on the internet are using images from the most famous piece of trans culture ever. You know, I wanted to go back to what you said in terms of, you know, these kind of wellness narratives and the
spirit. That's important.
Because I think a lot of those wellness narratives are about the esoteric, you know, like the hidden path of, you know, like we've got this, you know, secret knowledge that comes to us from a place of purity of, you know, Tibetan monks or whatever it is. And like that is actually a really very old strategy that comes from a lot of kind of fascism, you know, like fascists, you know, like Himmler looked up, like investigated esoteric traditions, you know, like there's a whole kind of, you know, history of right esotericism that I think we see in
Hitler himself wasn't really into
people
that.
Hitler
himself wasn't really into all that stuff, but a lot of his lieutenants were in that tool society and stuff like that. They were fully into, like, you know, plundering the past for symbols and spiritual narratives, etc., of purity, and they were obsessed with the idea of I mean Hitler did come into that with the whole idea of the Volk and, like, this idea of a pure Aryan race, you know, that went right back to, like, spiritual narratives, you know, about seeking Atlantis, seeking Hyperborea, you know, seeking this original pure race of perfect people descended directly from the sons of Apollo and all this kind of thing, you know. And this came all the way through to all the way through to the what are the Steiner bloody things, anthroposophy and theosophy and all these kinds of ones. They came right down from, like, you know, seance channeled narratives about you know, these originating cultures and this, like, you know, ancient civilization that was destroyed. you know, and then scattered everywhere, and there must be a return, you know, this weird rite of return kind of thing. Ah, my God. These are all interwoven narratives.
Yeah. And yeah. I think,
and it comes right through into wellness.
And I think, you know, like the question for me, like, you know, we can trace those kinds of, you know, relationships, but it's like, okay, what do we actually do with one another when we know that this is, you know, how culture organizes itself, you know, through these ideas of purity and pollution and all of that? It's like at a certain point, we just have to say, we are living together and amidst difference, and we need to not, you know, like you were talking about with border protocols. It's like we don't have to become one another to live convivially, to live hospitably with one another. And as soon as we stop accepting, you know, the other that is near us, and we want to eliminate that person, then we get into danger. But if we can sit with one another in our differences and not try to, you know, create the pure nation or the pure family, then we're starting to get somewhere, I think. You know, and you know, so much of politics today is about pretending that that other that is right across from us isn't there because we don't want them to be. It's like,
well, I mean, this brings us back to purity, and this is pretty much the goal of religion and the goal of a lot of, you know, New Age spirituality, you know, which is, you know, pretty much a religion, but for people who don't want to be doing a religion.
Yeah.
You know? So a lot of the nuns and others are still driven by this big quest for purity. There is grail quest. You know, where that sacred blood of, like, that royal blood, that sangreal, is there in the grail. Like, it's this big narrative of this hero's journey that is seeking some kind of purity. Every religion seeks purity, you know. I mean, so, you know, Buddhism is often touted as this sort of, oh, well, this is a gentler thing. This isn't like a colonizing sort of thing, but it is a quest for purity. You're constantly trying to purge, like your meditations are all about, you know, purging these these impure thoughts. It's like the first thing they get you to do is to breathe and then focus on, you know, noticing the thoughts that come in and then letting them go until you are free of all the impure thoughts. And then you get to experience, if you do enough meditation, just being your pure self, catching a glimpse of, hey, this is the pure spiritual being that you would get to be and can learn how to live in. You know, if you can ascend through all these lifetimes, then you will reach a state of purity, which, you know, I mean, that is it's a eugenics message. You know, eugenics itself is coming out of all of these, you know, these religious quests for purity and a pure state, a state of self-optimization.
Collides.
I mean, that's it. I mean, when it was sort of more, you know, Catholicism, and it was that sort of Holy Roman Empire taking up the reins of the Roman Empire and its quest, you know, it was for, you know, optimizing communities. So optimizing groups of people, the family, under the paterfamilias. So little communities that were situated within these hierarchies that were, you know, endorsed by the state, basically, or endorsed by the church, you know, for a long time. But the whole Protestant Reformation was sort of breaking that away so that each individual would be able to pursue their own self-optimization in the name of the deity. And so you saw, you know, this trend sort of, you know, sweep through a whole heap of different religions, dare I say, contaminating them. Dare I say, spreading through. See, you can't even talk. This is without these.
And, you know, this is the thing. It's like, well, pollution and contamination are inherent, you know, like, do you know about whales and pop songs? Like, whales spread their you know, their calls from one to the next in this kind of mimetic movement. You know, there's a contagious song. They're like, hey, you've got to listen to this, you know, whale banger. Gonna, you know, move from the one pod to the next. Like, you know, contamination and contagion, they happen because we are social beings, and also we're beings that are in a particular environment, in country, you know. Of course we're affected by what's around us and and I think the point is to make peace with that rather than continually trying to
But that's perfect, because animals aren't pure. They aren't this thing that, like, every whale in the world makes this sound if they're that species, because that's their patterning and the way they were created. Every dog communicates like this. If a dog has his ears here, that means this. And that means that. It's like, hang on a minute.
They have
cultural evolution going on as fast as the evolution that happens, that, you know, where they're bending themselves to suit the needs and preferences of the biped packmates that are, you know, needing things from them, and their communication changes as well. I have to tell you this idea of purity is in everything. I had to consult for a big artificial intelligence project recently. The whole idea of this was just, oh my God, they're creating artificial intelligence that will translate the speech of animals. You know, this Dr. Doolittle fantasy. If I could talk to the animals and walk with the animals, and they're just like, yep. So we're having this one AI that'll figure out dog language. And then everybody, you know, and I imagine they're thinking minimum viable product. You'll have an app where you can talk to your dog. You know what I mean? But it's like, dude, that dogs have dialects. It's not even by species. It's by where they are and the other dogs they're interacting with, but the humans they're interacting with. You know, it's different everywhere. It changes everywhere. These birds, what are we going to learn? Cockatoo? We're going to learn lyrebird? We're going to learn bowerbird? You know, all of these species and more, the sounds they make are the sounds they hear. You know, the lyrebird makes chainsaw noises, for fuck's sake. You know what I mean? You know, these aren't these pure things. You know, animal communication, animal culture, it's responsive to changes in the environment all the time, because all of these signals that they make and receive and contribute to, these are about seasonal changes all the time. And they're part of it. The noise that they add to that is part of the signal that lets everybody else and everything else in country know what to do. And all the voices together allows country to speak to us and tell us what needs to be done, where to burn, you know, what's going on differently in this season or even in this year from last year, you know, what's happening with deeper time, weather and climate patterns here, you know, all of these things. It's, anyway, it's just this idea, this simplistic idea of creation, of trying to make a simple explanation for it, of one intelligent designer who is pure and who probably, I don't know, would, in several of those religions, they make some kind of human avatar who is the perfect, pure human being whom we need to aspire to. You know, the Buddha in one or another of his incarnations.
Yeah, and you know, humanity itself is not pure. We have Neanderthal DNA. We have there's actually another species called Denovan. We also have some of them. Even humanity in itself never was pure. And so, you know,
they call these different species, and I keep thinking, how the hell is a Neanderthal a different species? He's in you.
He's in you. He's in me. He's in you. And I think in trying to think of nature as pure, you know, rather than, like, it's about not having a conversation with that nature.
Yeah, that's it.
Because
this idea that
Yeah.
Sorry, keep going.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, because, you know, like if you, you might not like what nature says. You know, you have that conversation with, you know, other species, and, you know, you can't just be like, oh, well, okay, I'm going to, you know, I'm just going to, you know, do whatever kind of farming it is that I want to do, or, you know, just going to knock this down so we can have some houses or whatever. It's like, you know, like you have to ethically respond if you have that conversation with the, you know, with other species. And, you know, that is not what our capitalist economy wants. So it's like, it's a way of not having a conversation with all kinds of others, I think.
I don't know. You look at all the all the narratives, and that you see these coming through in all the media, particularly film is a good thing to follow, you know. And I mean, we must all on some level know we're in trouble when 300 came out, you know, this is Sparta.
Yeah.
You know, that was about, you know, defending a boundary, you know, like a minority of disgruntled, you know, threatened pure people, you know, defending against these hordes from the east, you know, the foreigner, but also, you know, the very queer-coded Xerxes.
Oh, yeah.
You know, with lots of, like, you know, alterations and embellishments to the body, you know, of scarification and piercing and all these kinds of things, you know, and the introduction of, you know, exotic monstrous beasts like rhinoceroses being used for war and all this stuff, which I'm pretty sure they didn't do that. You know, there's always these elephants, you know, marauding in, etc. And but then you see a glimpse into the camp of the enemy, and it's all like you know, lots of queer sex going on, polyamory going on, and these disgusting you know, disabled people, you know, people with, you know, mutations and missing limbs and, you know, missing eyes, you know, just writhing together around the place. Oh my God, this is what's coming in to take over this pure place. And the 300 just standing, you know, and holding the line, hold the line. And you heard that a lot over lockdowns. You know, and with the rise of all these purity movements, they're like, you know, the truckers in Canada, you know, they were protesting a lot of COVID responses, a lot of public medicine responses, but they were also, you know, it was a mixed bag. They were also protesting trans stuff, trans kids at school, trans kids in sport, trans women in sport, like, et cetera, the whole bag. And, you know, right here in Melbourne, spray painted up on a billboard down the road, not far from where you and I are both sitting now. Hold the line, Canada. Line.
Yeah. And, you know, and what you say about the 300 and disability, you know, like those kinds of, you know, wellness cultures, it's about like making the body invincible so that, you know, the inevitable disability that comes with age, you know, you somehow escape that fate or.
Yeah.
Know this kind of like we can be pure, and you know, people with disabilities have, you know, have to use prosthetics sometimes, and that itself is a kind of impurity that, you know, and a weakness. You know, it's like, well, that too is something that eliminationists have historically. You know, the eugenics. It's like, you try to get rid of people with disabilities too, right?
That's it.
So it's all kind of interwoven via the medium.
That's it.
Via the medium of fascist Hollywood movies.
Yeah. Well, that hold the line thing. I mean, in 300, it was like, that's why the Hunchback was rejected from being able to, like, hey, can we have 301? 300.5. Like, yeah, dude, I can use a spear. Like, I can help you out. It's like, well, Show us how high you can lift your shit and how long you can. Sorry, we can't use you. It's like, what? I can't like move some corpses out of the way or chuck some rocks. Like, can I do something? No. And so, of course, you know, that one, of course, he must become the enemy. It's just insane. But at the same time, you know, like this fear and loathing of the other, they're constantly plundering the other.
Absolutely.
For source material, because they're constantly, you know, this fear of the East and of the Oriental and other, that Asian other, they're constantly plundering Asian spiritualities, Asian modalities of healing, all these kinds of things, you know. Right. That's constantly happening in the same way that they plunder other people's religion, they plunder Judaism. They're attacking the Capitol in the US, blowing shofars.
Yeah.
You know, in the name of a Christian God, while saying the Jews did it. Jews will not replace us. Will not replace us. You're blowing a shofar. You're being.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's about, you know, seeing other cultures, seeing the environment as, you know, sets of resources to extract from. And that is not the same as having a conversation with the other.
Mm.
Not the same as, you know, having to ethically respond to them. That is just seeing them as something you can use. And that is something we do to animals too. And to land and other cultures, as I said, we, but you know what I mean is like, you know, the West, right? You know, like,
I got you.
It's European culture. It's like seeing the natural world as just things you can use. Not actually being ethically responsible to them.
Yeah. I think where it all boils down to in the end, and this might be something to explore together, which I think, you know, we're definitely writing a paper.
Yeah, 100%.
That I think it's reimagining what quarantine is. So, you know, and so I don't know. What I don't want to do is be like, because this is just going the same way, is this, you know, indigenous, this ancient wisdom guru. You know, people are constantly reaching back for paleo diets, paleo this, paleo that, evolutionary psychology, you know, well, men were naturally dominant, you know, to try and reinforce purity things and bring forward these boundary relations now. And that's where I sit in the influence of verse. That's where I sit as a published author, you know, as well. I am that piece in the purity, the purity project, you know. I'm that ancient wisdom piece where you can draw things forward. So I'm very reluctant to do that, but I in this case, I think it's relevant to, and you know, and actually is counter to that, to look and say, well, hang on, you know, we have and had a very different approach to quarantine. You know, a lot of this has changed with native title, which the native title sort of shit fights and the mining royalties and all this kind of thing is about teaching us to have born boundaries, teaching us how to change ourselves into First Nations instead of First Peoples. You know, so it's teaching us a different kind of quarantine. So you'll find, you know, the same purity discourses infecting a lot of our communities. But if you get to the lore, if you go into the LORE, into that story, you see a very different relation. You know, if you go into all of our traditional meeting places for multi-tribal gatherings, if you go into our traditional ceremonies for meeting another group at your, you know, language group boundary, at the boundaries of your bioregion, which has its own tongue, you know, at all these places, the whole idea of embassy, the whole idea, particularly of quarantine, of, you know, how you manage your boundaries, that's different. And see, that's interesting because that comes into kin making then. How do you call people in? rather than calling them out, rather than blocking them? What are your protocols of quarantine? You know, you, yeah. So I know, you know, so for example, up north, there is a rule about honey, bees and beeswax crossing water. You know, those things aren't allowed to cross water. And there is a story for that that's policed by manta ray people because, you know, people with that totem. And so they have the role of ensuring that doesn't happen. Because that law shows, you know, the bees trying to cross the water and then the manta ray coming up and then crushing them and drowning them all. You know, there are some things like that in place. But, you know, quarantine isn't just everything stops here. You know, quarantine is about making embassy and then deciding how something, a new substance that's traded or a new species that's traded and that is coming in, that is going to be integrated, that this is accompanied by appropriate kin making, people becoming brothers, people adopting across, you know, so their children going there over into Asia, for example, in that trade, or New Guinea with that trade that's been around for thousands of years, or even just, you know, across thousands of kilometers of, you know, inland Australia, mainland Australia, you know, marriages being made. So that, you know, the languages of different groups are spoken and known, the law is kept, all these kinds of things. It's about sharing, you know, it's about bringing things in. So, you know, when the dingo entered Australia, that was through trade. And, you know, that was managed in to occupy the ecological niches of thylacines and to some extent quoll, and to then take up a lot of that dreaming around cycles, lunar cycles, you know, and that concept of regenerative, you know, life and death cycles and all that kind of thing, you know. So, you know, that law had to be done, that ceremony, there had to be ceremony for this. There had to be people who would come into totemic relation and speak for and manage that species. And then interact with all the other species to teach them how to come into relation with that one, you know. So I know that the embassy between Yolngu Makassan peoples, that was done under a tamarind tree. So there's a really big old tamarind tree on the beach there still, you know. And the tamarind tree is where that embassy was done, where that diplomacy was carried out and things negotiated under that perfect symbol of a tree that's not native to Australia.
Yeah,
but now is regarded as naturalized. It has a, you know, a stable position in the ecology, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, so I guess what I'm trying to get at is the idea of quarantine and what the narratives are currently around that within this sort of, you know, empire, this patriarchy, this sort of settler ethos. Which is more than that, you know, that's what it looks like in a colony, but, you know, we are living in a global empire. So I prefer to say empire.
Yeah.
What is quarantine under that? And, you know, what are all the narrative, or could we know that that's influencing the borders and immigration sort of panics, moral panics going on, medicine, panics around medicine, public medicine. Medical intervention, science, anti-intellectualism, you know, gender, sexuality, all of these things. There is a quarantining, you know, of the pure against the impure. So I don't know, like quick summary of what quarantine looks like within these purity discourse, these spiritualized purity discourses, but then also what do you think quarantine could become and the idea of quarantine could become with a little bit of queer theory, you know, intersecting with some Indigenous standpoint, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, what I think quarantine is I think, you know, you mentioned the idea of hierarchy and quarantine as it stands, you know, in global empire is about hierarchy. And we on the one hand don't have a kind of embassy conversation when like a new product gets launched. It's like, oh yeah, no, where we all just be like, oh yeah, AI is now here, and you know, nobody gets to have a kind of conversation about that. But on the other hand, you know, maintaining the purity of certain kinds of privileged forms becomes a kind of violence to people who are excluded and who are at the bottom of that hierarchy.
Mm.
So I think, you know, we need to remember a kind of, you know, that there is power that is being exerted, and, you know, it's being exerted to sort of maintain extractive economies of all kinds.
Yes.
You know, like the purity of the nation border in this country is in some ways about, you know, maintaining access to natural resources.
Yeah.
And,
well, you it's know, yeah, you have to install governments that are about purity agendas.
Yeah.
In the countries where you extract the lithium that's needed to run this technology.
Yeah, exactly.
Uganda, and now, like, you know, moves are being made towards Argentina and all these sort of things. You look in all these countries where these things are extracted. You know, by the global, you see very, very quickly, very fascist, you know, purity eugenics oriented sort of dictatorships popping up, who have like death sentences for queer stuff and all that kind of thing.
All of that stuff. And, you know, those types of, you know, and Angela Davis says fascism is in democracy, that that's in democratic capitalist countries, that it's in there. And I think it's a kind of drive towards like how intense it is, and, you know, what communities experience it. Because, you know, so Davis says, you know, like Black men in the prison system in the United States are already experiencing fascism.
Yeah.
Being removed from the social and the kind of, you know, saturation of power. So quarantine, in that sense, it's like, well, you know, it's how intense that border pollution is, how socially, you know, dispersed, how many borders we throw up. In terms of queering that now, and, you know, and I think, you know, you and I need to have some more conversations about this, you know, like in terms of where queerness meets indigeneity. And I think,
well, either that or we'll separate those two things out, and you can have the queer section of the paper at the start. And but then we'll just keep that separate from the more pure sort of discourse.
But, you know, like also like I mean, I'm sort of, you know, aware that like how do, you know, sister girls and brother boys, you know, how do they feel about that kind of conversation and that kind of intersection would be something that I think is also worth kind of exploring.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like I say, as a, you know, as a settler, as you know, a white Jew.
Well, I think they're sick of having to just the queer theory part is just declaring a positionality statement at the start of the paper, and then having to do the rest as this homonormative freaking analysis. What I mean?
Yeah.
We experience the same thing with Indigenous standpoint theory. You know, it's Linda Smith, 2000, you know, it's like, dude.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the thing, we have to just call our interview data like yarning data and deep listening or duddery or something, and then recolonize it all in the analysis, analysis of the softest, stupidest sort of way of doing analysis, you know, that doesn't really mean anything and it's just subjective. But we didn't even really get to put our subjectivities in there. I guess everybody's sick of that.
Yeah. I'm not saying that
wants to do something more meaningful.
Yeah.
Intersectionality to be something more than just a declaration of one's, you know, positionality.
Yeah. Yeah. So
there's a freaking human brand in the marketplace of what? Anyway.
Yeah. No, I'm like, you know, so with you in terms of that, like that tokeny bullshit is just, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, no, that's not what I, you
yeah,
know.
Yeah. We have to make embassy. We got to make proper embassy.
Yeah, yeah, like actually yeah. have that, you know, conversation in ways that is not just like, oh, we'll just do academia in the exact same way, but we'll cite, you know, the two people that you require, and then we'll just do it, you know, business as usual. It's like, no,
yeah,
that's
yeah.
actually not responding genuinely to difference and to, you know, like, you know, like what you said in Sam talk about changing how, you know, how people think. Like, it's not just like, oh, I'm, you know,
not what they think.
I'm not just like, you know, the native informant who, you know, gives a little bit of like, you know, colorful stories. Yep. Then you go on and do things in the exact same way. It's like, you know, that to me is, you know, like as a queer trans person, it's like, well, like what does it, like I think that's completely useless is if all we do is tick the boxes and then do the things the exact same way. So how do we queer and trans quarantine? I think I don't have a great answer for you yet, but I'm going to think about it.
Well, it's in our non-human, our non-human research participants, you know, and I think where we sit together in these diasporic spaces that we're in, you know, with you as a Jew and with both of us as having these itinerant kind of ways of being in the world, you know, where we sit, like our tamarind tree on the beach, our place of embassy is with the migratory species that seasonally move through the places where we are. These are the ones that we must be in dialogue with. We need to move like they move. And
you can't
transform
just
like they transform. Yeah.
Like this kind of like idea of, you know, space where like every Starbucks in the world is exactly the same. It's a non-space. It's like no, like if you only see the world around you as interchangeable, then that kind of, you know, itinerant thing doesn't actually mean anything. It's just, you know, but
well,
you know,
no wonder power is worried about pollution from other entities from outside their space, because that's what they do. They take a Starbucks, this unchanging non-entity. They take it and they spread it as a contagion, as a pollutant, as a toxic, you know, entity, you know, throughout the world. That's what invasion is. I guess what we're doing is non-invasive, non-penetrative, you know, flows. We're doing the flows and the weaves.
Yeah.
Just as in the same way that there are no places where it's like, well, God put the zebras here. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so they don't go there. And it's like, well, sorry, but those things migrate. You know, these herds move around seasonally over vast distances, you know, all the birds do the same. And, you know, you don't have a totem that just sits in one place. You don't have an ideology that's just this and doesn't move. And that's the reality of empire, is that they don't freaking do that either.
But, you know, the thing is, like, we cannot buy ourselves liberation, you know. We can't like buy ourselves through, you know, like we have to be shaped by what is around us, is I think, you know, the commonality of it. And queerness to me is about saying like that encounter with what is around you is not necessarily going to be what you expect.
That's it.
You have to be like, I am open to being surprised by something that seems foreign and scary and, you know, altogether different from what I expect, but I'm open to being shaped by it.
Yeah.
Rather than being like, hey, there's something that I didn't expect and I need to just expel it because, you know, that is just violence and it leads to, you know, bad shit.
We can't even manage that with drag queen story hour, so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I remain an optimist that living with one another is possible. You know, and I think like having conversations with this, like this, well, it's like, okay, well, how do we live with one another? And when I say one another, I don't just mean humans, I mean everything. How do we live with plant species as well as animal species? How do we do that living with is like the question.
And ceremony is the process.
Yeah.
That you move through for that. And,
yeah.
You know, yeah, you know. I think the queer community gets ritual, gets festival, ceremony,
you got to have
altered states held together in community and in group and etc. These are things we can do together and do together. It's usually called the arts, but we have to make sure we're finding the rigorous ways and ways to show that intellectual rigor in how we bring that into the academy as well. Not just as, hey, I did this painting, here's a 12,000 word exegesis, give me a master's, please. In ways that go beyond that.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, like, we have to think our way through that kind of, you know, Christian heritage, you know, to understand its effect on us.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think the idea that we are innocent of its kind of imprints is not, it's not plausible. So we have to think our way through it in order to get somewhere else is my basic.
That's it.
Way of approaching things.
Well, you just go with the flow. When they say we have to do more studies of Western civilization, I say, yeah, I'll lean right into that. I'll study the shit out of your civilization.
Right. It's not
you might not like what you see.
Right. You know,
yeah.
I think there's that thing, you know, you see the dominant culture around you from a different positionality as that culture itself.
Yeah.
You know, and I 100% believe in biting the hand that feeds you. And, you know, Trojan horsing. You know, you got a Trojan horse institutions and, you know, make space for yourself because, you know, if you don't do that, if you don't make space for you when people like you, you get squashed. So how do you Trojan horse those institutions is the question, right?
Well, you got to lick that hand a bit too, probably.
You do. Sometimes you do. We all got to eat.
Yeah, that's it. All right. Well, I just think that's a good start for us to imaginate our way into this this paper. I think it'll be a good one. That's beautiful.
Let's meet up in person then if you're, you know.
Yeah. Because you're just around the corner, so let's just do that.
Yeah.
And let's wear the shit out of this thing.
Love it.
And I'll bring the ancient wisdom. You bring the wine.
That's good too.